I'm Monica Olson.
And I'm Jennifer Walsh.
And you're listening to the Biophilic Solutions Podcast, where every other week we sit down with experts and thought leaders across industries in order to explore the innate connection between humans and nature and why we need nature to thrive.
We truly believe that in order to tackle the global environmental problems we're facing, we as humans must reconnect to the natural world and come to a better understanding of how we fit in and how we are so interconnected. So in every episode, we'll interview new guests that help us uncover and highlight nature-based solutions to get us on a path to greater health, tackling climate change, and ultimately getting outside and connecting with nature.
So let's get to today's episode. Hey, Jennifer.
Hey, Monica.
Jennifer. You remember a few months ago when we interviewed Karen Pearson from FIT. Remember how she told us all about that incredible FIT design school brand called AlgaeKnit that kind of grew out of a class?
Absolutely. And when they were students at FIT, a mutual professor connected Alice Gajewski and Tessa Callahan due to their interest in developing more sustainable products with unexpected materials. They went on to found AlgaeKnit, which was specifically focused on creating fiber from algae, and were the winners of the first ever biodesign challenge in 2016.
Yes, and so Tessa and Alex have expanded since then, and they're really now utilizing abundant ocean materials, and they've rebranded as Keel Labs. They have a signature product called Kelson, which is a yarn derived from sea kelp. It's got very, very low environmental footprint than conventional fibers, and they've had a ton of success partnering with brands, raising capital, and they're hoping to launch the product out into the world pretty soon. But before we get to the interview, another cool thing I want to point out about Tessa and Alex is they were named Forbes 30 Under 30 last year, which obviously is a huge deal.
It is such a huge deal. Okay, these young women are so impressive. So in this interview, we chat with Tessa and Alex about the promise of kelp as a regenerative raw material, the process of turning kelp into a functional textile, and we dive into, no pun intended, the challenges and rewards of building a company with sustainable innovation at its core.
So let's get to our interview with Tessa and Alex. Hi, you guys. Thank you so much for joining us on Biophilic Solutions this morning, or maybe it's afternoon at this point. How are you?
We're great.
Yeah, doing good. Living it up one day at a time.
Good, good. Hey, Jen, how are you? I know you're great. A little bit in a tougher situation today. Maybe it'd be a little bit quieter with where you're located. But
yes,
wanted to sort of jump in and talk a little bit about your backgrounds and how you got to this point with what was formerly known as AlgaeKnit and now Keel Labs. How did it come about?
Tess and I are actually both designers. So our backgrounds are in design. And while we were in school, that's where we had met. We were connected through a mutual professor that was like, you guys are both talking about something that you guys need to talk about together. So I'm just going to put you guys in touch. And that's kind of where that was like the real beginning. And that's where we started to get to know each other and started talking about this new world of materials and how we needed better materials for the products that we were designing to actually produce more sustainable goods. So that really was how we got Keel going.
And you guys were fashion designers, right? You weren't coming up from an actual, but from a product, but fashion was what you guys were into. You guys are at FIT, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And so once you came together, how did you decide on, basically it's a kelp product that turns into it, you know, you guys are turning it into a knit or a fiber, but how did you decide, like, why oceans, why was that that you were sort of looking for versus other plant-based materials?
One of the biggest components there was purely out of necessity. We didn't study textiles and work in the industry thinking that seaweeds are great. How do we make seaweeds into something amazing? It happened out of, we know what we have currently on land is not meeting the needs that we have from a planetary longevity perspective. And so when thinking about how you would be able to negate the negative impacts that are created with the multiple materials that we're using today, the ocean was really the only place. And abundance and accessibility were key there. And so push came to shove and seaweeds and the relevant extracted polymers that come from that really drove the innovation so that we as designers could meet our needs throughout the supply chain.
It's so cool. I remember Dr. Karen Pearson, our good friend, was raving about the two of you a few months ago. And so Monica and I said, okay, we have to talk to you guys because I think it's so fascinating. Not many people, I know we love Karen. She's so great, yeah, but she's just couldn't stop talking about you. And we were enamored with what you were creating, especially such young minds that you are. And it's just so interesting that because a lot of people don't think about the ocean as a resource for fashion or materials. So how did you even consider the ocean as a resource for a material? Or is it just something like that came to you? Like, how did you even think about that?
Well, we were working, as Tess was saying, and we were trying to set these constraints that we had to fit into. So we wanted a material that, first of all, we wanted to build one business, and that business was creating new technology for new materials, and not three different businesses where we were also having to build out the supply chains and then also specialty equipment. So we were like, great, we're just going to do one thing at a time. We need access to a lot of material. The land-based materials or the synthetic materials weren't what we were after. So we turned to our ocean and we were like, great, so this is where we're starting. There's a ton of seaweed in the world. It's used for several different industries. So the supply chain is already in place. And textiles are made all the time, right? So how can we fit into those existing industry factories and things like that so that we don't have to reinvent that wheel and allow our product to scale quickly and get into the hands of customers sooner?
We know it's abundant. We know it sequesters carbon, kind of like trees do, the seaweed or kelp. But how do you harvest it? Or was there already a process to harvest it that you could kind of get a raw product? So I'm sort of curious there, right? Like, because I think that's interesting. You're like, okay, well, what's already, we're not having to create a harvesting system and a supply chain and a da-da-da and transportation. And so tell me just a little bit about that. And then how do you make it? Like, what is the raw material? Like, how does it come to you and or before it's actually being spun into a thread? Like, tell us how it gets to be a thread. I guess that's the question that I have.
I'm so fascinated by that too, Monica.
So luckily, we don't have to learn how to harvest seaweed on our own. There are people already doing that, which is great. And we're able to work with industry processors. So they basically are the ones that buy or harvest the seaweed themselves, and then they turn it into powders. Various different polymers are extracted from that and created into what becomes our raw material. So we start at that stage. So we work with a powder form of the seaweed, and then we develop our special secret sauce and spin it into our fibers from there. And then from the fibers, we turn it into yarns set up in ways that brands are familiar with so that they're able to purchase something that they understand and know how to work with and can convert into their products. But there's various methods when it comes to seaweed harvesting. We try to really check in on our suppliers and vet our suppliers too for how they harvest the seaweed. There's wild harvest, there's cultivated, there's farmed. So we really try to keep tabs on that as much as possible. However, it is a new space for the seaweed world to be really transparent about how they handle all of this.
And are these locations all over the country that you're harvesting from, like the Pacific Northwest or Florida or the Northeast, or where does it all come from?
It goes beyond the US. We are working globally all over the world right now to find who the right partners are for us. We're small scale, so scale is also kind of something to consider. Not everyone is able to supply us at the size we're at, although they might be great partners for down the line.
Yeah, you kind of think about regenerative agriculture, right? And so it's not just how it's harvested. It's not just, and I don't know if that would be like a certification, like natural or organic for seaweed. That's sort of like maybe, but that seems weird, right? But probably. But it's really how the people who are harvesting it are being treated. Do they have a fair wage? All those good questions that we can sort of extrapolate from agriculture on land. And then the other thing I think is sort of interesting, as Jen and I have learned interviewing people over the past couple of years, is in wool, there's like fiber sheds, kind of like a watershed. Yeah. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to learn. And so I don't know what you would call it, but it's not quite like a wine where it's, you know, regional, but there probably are, right, regional and different types of seaweed. And I'm sure some do different things. Is that it? Do you need a certain kind of seaweed to do it?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like in the weeds a little bit, because I do want to sort of talk about the chemistry, not the secret sauce. I'm curious, like, how you were like, okay, great, it's a powder. You know, we're going to have to figure out how to turn it into a fiber now.
So there are thousands of species of seaweed, and they all grow in different temperatures, different regions, have different growth rates. Some grow really fast, some grow a little slower, different like overall size, different composition. It varies by season. It varies by year. And so for us, because we're working with specific polymers, we look for that percentage, like a high percentage in different species, and focus on those so that we are making the most of that organism and allowing other polymers to be extracted in species that aren't particularly preferable for us. So trying to be mindful in that way as well. Maybe you could talk about the process a little bit from there.
Yeah, but I think just adding on to that as well, it's a really particularly exciting time. Maybe I'm just a nerd about it, but a really exciting time in the seaweed and the aquaculture space, because although seaweed in particular is grown on every single continent, and the extraction processes and various products that it's used for have been well established for hundreds of years. And so now, especially with the climate crisis really coming to a head, a lot of research and initiatives are being established to expand the industry and really take it from something that just exists to something that is actively helping the planet to both decarbonize and deacidify the oceans as well. So there's a lot of new procedures and processes and expansion. And so certainly a really exciting time, especially I think over the next 5 to 10 years as the industry develops into this new landscape.
Are you seeing more and more people interested in this kind of material from not just SIT, but like across the world?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even since we started, there's really been an expansion and excitement and interest around not just the textile space, but also in the seaweed space. I mean, the fact that we're even here having this conversation is kind of indicative of that. But yeah, that's been really exciting for us to see and be able to have conversations like this around something that was once quite niche.
Absolutely. We can nerd out all day long, by the way. We are very excited about this conversation. So keep going.
Happens, right? We're good.
Oh, yeah. So you go from the powder, you do the secret sauce, it turns into a fiber. What would you equate it to most closely? Like if I was going to, I don't know, knit or loom or use it in it, because it's not only clothing, it can be utilized in fabrics for furnishings, couches, curtains, you know, pillows. What would you equate it to? Is it, can you make it into different types? Or, because obviously it's not, you know, we use different fibers like linen or wool or obviously these synthetics that have been so prevalent, and we're all guilty of it. It's in everything, right? You know, combined, all these carbon-based, fossil-based synthetics that go into creating stretchy everything, right? Yeah. And so what properties does it have, and where are you finding it most useful, I guess, is the question I'm trying to ask.
I want to quickly just talk about the process and how it's like similar to in other industry, like ways of manufacturing. So we weren't trying to reinvent the wheel when we started. So in order to even create our fiber, we use a traditional industry process known as wet spinning.
Okay.
And that's where kind of the customization of the finished product begins. At that point, you could really start to determine the type of finished product you're going to have and the finished yarn in our case. And then from there, we can kind of, dictate further and affect the characteristics of it and things like that.
Yeah. To kind of jump in and speak about the properties a little bit. And so as Alex was saying, this idea or this methodology of wet spinning is how fibers like viscose, certain acrylics, certain spandexes are made. And so because of that, there is a slight similarity to something like viscose, where, you know, it's a pulp that's extracted from trees. They use a lot of very bad, scary chemicals. We do not. But what you get out is a filament that is chopped up into your staples. So like mimicking a natural material like a cotton or a wool or a linen, as you mentioned. And you can customize, as Alex was saying, the length and how that's created into various yarns and textiles. The interesting thing about new materials is something shocking in that they're new. And so although you can have a lot of similarities to a particular fiber or source, you will inherently have differences as well. And so when we look at the core and easiest comparable material, a viscose is quite similar simply because of the process. However, what really is unique about Kelsen, our fiber, is that it feels and looks a lot like cotton in a way that other man-made naturals simply don't. And so although it's one-to-one same, it does give you the same feeling and emotional response that you get, which I think is really what, as consumers, we're all looking for. And so that's something that, especially thinking about markets, the fashion industry has been really, really focused on and driving. Cotton is a massive risk. It's not talked about a ton, but the impacts are quite detrimental to our planet. And so finding alternative sources for something that can perform similarly is really a core there. That being said, as you kind of alluded to, the beauty of fibers is that they don't stop at one single type of textile or even one type of yarn. So fashion and apparel is really our first market, primarily because of the need and demand. However, as you were saying, some of the exciting other places that also use similar fibers are interiors, are automotives. There are, you know, a ton of other categories that are also unexpected where fibers are used, like building materials and insulation, like makeup wipes, like tampons. There's so many categories. But again, I think the biggest kind of priority that business needs to have is focus. We're very excited in a lot of areas, but we want to make sure that we're solving one problem at a time.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
Jennifer, guess what's coming up and where we get to hang out?
What's that, Monica?
The Biophilic Leadership Summit. It's back this March 24th through 26th.
Oh my gosh, I cannot wait to see you in person again. It's been way too long.
I know, me too. And we invite all our listeners to come to this year's summit. We're going to be exploring biophilic placemaking and how we use biophilic principles to promote health, happiness, and vitality in public spaces.
Yes, and I was just reading over the schedule, which I'm very excited about. There are so many great speakers and panels. And when you get to join us, I'll be doing a nature walk and moderating a wonderful panel on activating community spaces with two incredible women, an architect and an urban planner.
So this summit is put on by the Biophilic Institute and Biophilic Cities Project. So you can also come meet all of the leading experts in biophilia. And in addition to all incredible multiple presentations, we're going to have all sorts of great farm-to-table meals, plus cocktails, some book signings, and lots of networking, which is always a favorite. And it's going to be at your and my favorite place, the Inn at Serenbee.
Yep, that's one of my favorite places, as you know. So join us in Serenbee for the 6th Annual Biophilic Leadership Summit from March 24th to March 26th, 2024.
And you can learn more about the summit and register today at biophilicsummit.com.
That's biophilicsummit.com. We hope to see you there.
We'll see you soon. Bye, Jen.
Bye. So this is so cool because, again, like you just said, it's not just one thing. You can utilize it for so many different things. Are you educating people in a certain way to teach people? Like, how do people then find out about this fiber? What is your go-to, I don't know, educational tool to tell people like this is available versus those very detrimental use of cotton and other fabrics that are really hurting the climate and the planet?
There are a number of things we try to do. I think there's like education from the end user side, and then there's also education for our customers who happen to be brands and industry manufacturers. And so how we go about those things is we go to conferences to meet brands and talk about this and set up intimate meetings, one-on-one meetings where we can show them some of the reports we've run, some of the testing we've done on our product to show that our impact is different than others. And then on the end consumer side or end user side, we try to talk about seaweed and our product, Kelsen, on different channels, especially through social media. And we found that to be really engaging and impactful.
One of the really important things and kind of one of our core values is I think it's really easy, and we see this throughout the market, to get lost in the negative and can feel really scary and unmotivating. We know how bad things are. I, as an individual, don't necessarily know what to do about it. And so I think really the core message that we want to make sure that we're ingraining in any form of public or private sphere is that, yes, things are bad. Yes, things can be better. And let's focus on how to fix it and not get derailed by how we're not doing anything, because it's forward momentum that will actually create this.
Yeah, no, we had a great interview yesterday or the day before, Jen, with a gentleman out of the UK, and he started writing a book on positive tipping points, right? And so how, you know, there's a magic number of 3.5% that if you get 3.5% of people doing something, it actually turns into this tipping point. And that seems like a very small number. And so I thought that was sort of an interesting. So he talked about positive tipping points, whether we move on to EVs or complete streets or whatever sort of, it could be anything. It doesn't have to be climate related. So I think it's sort of interesting to start thinking about setting the goal of like, okay, what's going to be the positive tipping point for uptick or pickup of the product in the marketplace, and starting with, say, apparel, right? Or whatever that line is. Do you equate this like, or do you see a little bit of, not from the sustainability, because I know there's a lot of here and there about bamboo, but, you know, bamboo became a little bit of a positive poster child for potentially a better solution to cotton. And I'm not deep into the pros and cons of that, but it did become this fiber that could be used anywhere. And it was very sustainable and you could grow it really fast and all the, you know, positive things. I'm not sure about the water usage and stuff, but do you see that you can start to talk to people about like something like that as an early adoptive choice? And obviously yours is of course better, you know, but you're like, you know, here's why this is even a better or more sustainable thing. Is that a way to sort of educate people to say why you need, like, I love one of the articles said, do I want a sweater made out of seaweed? And I'm like, I love, yeah. You know, so is that an easier parallel to start educating people?
Yeah, I think in some ways it depends who you're talking to, but I think that figure that you mentioned, the 3.5%, what an incredible figure. I would say those are early adopters. Like that is a representation of the people that like were waiting at 3 a.m. for the first iPhone to come out, you know, outside the Apple store. And we have some of those people too that are early adopters, believers, see the possibility and the impact of our product long term. And then you have some of the later stage adopters that need to feel more comfortable about it, need to feel more sure. And that's kind of the people that we might use the bamboo example for. Like, okay, yeah, seaweed is different, but it's not that different at the end of the day. Like, have you heard of bamboo products or have you heard of tree pulp products? Like, it's not that far from what you're used to.
And who are you seeing out there? Because obviously there's the consumer that we can put demand on the fashion retailers and manufacturers to sort of change their habits by our purchasing power. But who are the actual manufacturers and retailers that are out there that are in front that you're seeing from a mass market as well as maybe some of the more upscale brands?
The exciting thing is that so many more than I could possibly list in the next 45 minutes.
Sure.
But I think kind of an interesting figure, and it's probably outdated by this point, but a couple of years ago, about 12.5% of global fashion brands had committed to sustainable change and goals by 2030. Okay. And so when you think about the tipping point, it's clear. And I think over the last 3 years, even outside of that, there's been a massive shift towards an understanding that sustainability, and I wish I had a better word, although
I know
the words care about that, but that sustainability is no longer something that is just a marketing tool or shows that you're on the cutting edge, that in order for you to sustain your supply chains and the literal fibers that are creating your business, you will no longer be able to continue sourcing those and supplying your customers with your products if you do not change and diversify the raw materials that you're working with. And so because of that, I would say whether they're taking action or not, most, if not all major, especially fast fashion brands that you can think of are involved in this conversation. There are a couple, and one is an example. H&M, who's one of our investors and a really close partner to us, is, you know, really looking into this both from a financial perspective and from a supply chain and support perspective. Obviously, business models, long-term transitions of what true success as a company looks like also needs to be evaluated. But I think for us as a company, and maybe as a populace, it would be ignorant to pretend like they do not exist and that they also too do not need solutions. We're quite proactive about addressing things head on in that way, because if things are to continue down the road that they are on, how can we help to transition that into something that's more sustainable rather than hoping that one day it won't be the case?
Right.
Yeah, I think that's so, no, I think it's just so great because, again, you're opening that door to conversations, which is like Monica and I always talk about. We're always leading with the lens of hope and also solutions. So that's exactly where you are, that access point of like, how do we share the knowledge, get more people interested, and create a movement around why we need to change. So I think it's really interesting you have investors like H&M that are like listening and actually taking note and saying, okay, how do we make changes, and then share that. And again, that education just keeps rolling and rolling, and it's really impactful. Really impactful.
Well, and our, you know, because you have the Kia Labs is the parent company and Kelsen's with the product. And so is this something where when it's utilized in a fabric or manufacturing, do you have a logo and a tag? And like, are you getting to the point where people will be attaching that to the hang tags and stuff? Because I think that's the consumer side, right? Like, what's inside here? Cotton did a really good job, didn't they? You know, with their branding.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really critical and surprisingly quite complex question or answer. So on one hand, the branding of our product in various brand collections, et cetera, is really critical, not just for us, but for the brand itself, mm-hmm. because if they're able to drive a higher value product because of the recognition and consumer recognition, like take Gore-Tex, for example.
Yeah, that's a great example.
Is really something that we mimic ourselves off of, which is, you know, the value and trust that they have with the consumer. However, one of the things that is just an ongoing challenge for the industry is thinking about the labels that say 75% polyester, 25% cotton, whatever that may be, because it's not just made up, it's regulated by the various countries and regions that it's being distributed in. And because there are these new, us included, raw materials and companies that are going into that, figuring out how to navigate the legislative process that is not very active or innovative is something that we're talking through with brands, we're talking through with other companies, but that's something that I think is a little bit more tricky than it sure. might seem when you just look into your inside label.
It definitely is a super tricky space. I recently was talking to someone who works in the recycled space, and they're developing a recycled poly, but on the label, they can only write poly. So you're losing like such a huge amount of value that your company is bringing, because all of a sudden this new technology that you developed around the fiber you're producing is now commoditized.
Yeah, that's fair. It's not bringing that higher value.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is very interesting, and I think it's changing too. I was just looking at a pair of like workout pants that I have. And it was funny because on the printed label inside, it said that it was 100% recyclable. And I personally know for a fact that the ingredients that it's made out of, because it's a blend, it's not recycled. I don't know how you would recycle it. And it got me into this whole tizzy of what's okay to put on your label and not. Yeah. Maybe that happened 5 years ago, but that's actually not okay.
Lying. Yeah.
But for us, regardless, it's really important to have our Kelsen brand, our Keel Labs name featured somewhere to ensure that the customer is receiving a quality material that we have guaranteed of that quality and other commitments that we've made along the way, like embedded into that product.
Where can you find it now? Like, can I find a Kelsen made product or a product made with Kelsen fiber? Like, is that something we're getting close to, or can I go to H&M and buy it now? Or
you're welcome to come take us for a visit and come see it in person. It's not actively available on the market right now, although we do have a number of collaborations that we're working towards with various brands. So hopefully you'll be able to see that soon. And trust me, the second that you do, everyone in the whole world will be shouting from the rooftops.
Oh my God, yes. Good. That's good, amazing. Good, good. Yeah, because I just think it's like we're ready for that, right?
We're, you know, we're ready.
You're ready. You know, you are. Well, and we talk about Jen comes out of the beauty industry, and even that regulation. Like, I feel like God. Who were we talking to? Credo's founder. You know that like
Annie.
Yep. They had just changed some sort of legislation in Congress in like December or January this year that provided more transparency. But it's unbelievable that we just sit here. Like, I read a whole article on sunscreen, and you know, we don't even have the best of the best technology compared to around. Yeah, I know. Don't get me started.
Whole other thing.
Yeah, and so it's all of our opportunity and to sort of get out there and start asking the questions and demanding, and you know, in a small part, you know, we can help amplify your story. But
when we talk about ingredients, we often just correlate that with food, and we don't really think about ingredients in the cosmetics that we use, or in the clothes that we wear, or in the furniture that we like sit on. We don't even think about that.
The off gas.
So true.
Some of that stuff.
Oh yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
And so collabs coming, which I think is so cool. And I think that can have a real interesting opportunity in the marketplace. Obviously H&M as an investor is really cool. And that I imagine they'll want to do a line or something really specific. What else is happening? Like, are you still doing development of different types of fibers? Like, what are you guys up to on like a day-to-day basis?
It's quite multifaceted. We're up to a lot every day. But the biggest thing right now that we're really focused on is scaling the fiber and the technology that we have developed and validated on various external and internally standard equipment. And so with that requires increased infrastructure, partnerships and collaborations with industry scale manufacturers. It requires funds from investors, and it requires the proactive support and sign on from brands as well. And so really our goal as a company is to ensure that we're creating as much impact as possible. And in order for us to do that, we need as great of a scale as possible, and we need to go as fast as possible. So all of those things really require keen attention and focus on how do we get this to scale as quickly as we can and bring it to market. And so that's really every member of our team's core focus every single day is let's make sure that we're doing that. And if it's outside of those bounds, let's reassess if it's really worth our time.
Yeah. Do we have the right people? Do we have the right space? Do we have the right equipment? It's like a constant assessment every day. How do we keep getting to our goals?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you guys are in North Carolina now, is that?
We sure are.
Love it. So when you come down for Venture Atlanta, hopefully crossing fingers you get into that, you're just right down the street. You're going to have to come see me or let me know. I'll come see you guys up in the city.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Although don't jinx it by putting...
Okay, I'm not going to say a word about it. We'll take that part out of it.
But I absolutely will come see you. That sounds fantastic. I went there for the first time for like 8 hours
oh my gosh.
Recently, but I'm very excited to come back.
Yeah, it's a great city. It's a lot of fun. Different from New York.
Monica's always trying to grab people out of New York and visiting her.
In Saranby, yeah. So we're just south of the airport, but we're like a sustainable community.
New York, yeah.
Oh, we're there all
the time. Jen's in New York. She's in New York and I'm here, so.
New York is like, it becomes like a pass-through city almost now for us.
There you go.
We're there all the time.
Yeah, that's great. So how can we find you? Are you on social? Should we follow you
guys?
How
can we support?
Keel, should we follow Kelson? Yeah. Like, what's going on? Give us all the details. We'll put them in the show notes. How can we support you?
Well, you guys are already by having us on the show, so thank you. And we would appreciate people talking about us and spreading the word and talking about these cool seaweed products we're developing, like Kelson. Of course, we are on social media. We're on TikTok, we're on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter. Follow us.
Love
Our
it.
Handle is keel.labs. We also have a great newsletter that we send out on a monthly basis.
Great.
We highlight new updates, new progress. Of course, we'll feature any brand launches on there in the future. So yeah.
Good. Okay. We're going to include all that. And we just loved having you guys. I'm so excited to watch what you do next. And we're here for you.
Yeah. It's exciting to watch the both of you. You're so passionate. You're so excited. And the future is really all yours. So thanks for sharing with us today.
Thank you guys.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Oh my God, our pleasure.
Honor and pleasure. I grew up going to a beauty bar, and so I'm like, dream come true.
Love it.
Awesome. Full circle. Okay, so I want to say one thing. I got to have coffee with Alex this past week, and she is delightful even in person, and it was just so fun to really dive into even more so how Alex and Tessa really got their start. And I'm just even more impressed with how they really navigated the landscape. But let me just say, like, the first thing that's really stood out to me from the interview was just how thoughtful both Tessa and Alex are about their entire approach to Keel Labs and developing Kelson. From the way they're utilizing existing supply chains to what they're looking for internationally for the most responsible suppliers. It's so clear that they really have thought about the entire process in a really holistic way.
Yeah, and it's not a simple thing, right? I mean, the whole supply chain is incredibly complicated. And I really, really liked how Tessa made the point about highlighting sustainability is becoming more central to the business model of fashion brands. And companies cannot ignore the imperative or they're going to get left behind, you know, not just in terms of their public image, but from a business perspective as well.
Yes, I thought that was really super interesting. And she also said something like companies need to start evaluating what success actually looks like. And I found that really helpful. I never really thought about that as a bottom line. And sort of reminded me of our conversation with Mara Hoffman, where the first leap into her eco-consciousness fashion was scary and felt totally laden with risks, but has a sincere blossomed into a whole new philosophy about slowing down and being more aware of the world around you and getting out of pressure cooker of constant production and constantly having to do new stuff.
Yeah, I like that comparison. You and I talk a lot about key pieces that you can have long term rather than just this fast fashion. And it's really rough because we're being hit on social media, especially Instagram, with clothing more and more. It's kind of like very tempting. And so really trying to be thoughtful about your purchases. But I think you're right. Like, how can they shift their way of thinking where profitability is only one aspect of a successful company? I mean, obviously, you have to have the funds to continue running it. But you don't want profit to come at the expense of people or the planet, because then, I don't know, it's not really true success.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't agree more. And I'm kind of really glad you said that, because you're right. Social media is bombarding us all the time with buy, 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 more, more, more. Yeah, but we have to be more intentional about how we're using social and what brands are really honing into this craft of how do we do better in a world that's constantly trying to sell us everything all the time.
So check out the show notes. We've got some great resources to learn more about Keel Labs, and we promise to keep our listeners updated as Kelson gets out there into the world, and you'll hopefully be able to find a hang tag on clothing to make that smart purchase.
Absolutely. Okay. I can't wait for that. And I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks, Monica.
Bye, Jen.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the podcast, we would love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast app, give us a 5-star rating, and please leave us a review.
It really goes such a long way towards helping us reach a wider audience and sharing these amazing interviews and solutions with the world.
Absolutely. So thanks so much for following and reviewing the podcast, and we'll be back with another amazing interview in 2 weeks. You're now a part of the Biophilic Movement.